Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
The Rational Jihadi.
Hello everybody, I'm Hayden Prowse and welcome to the movement for rational, easygoing and extremely open-minded jihad.
And today I'm very excited because we have George Monbiot on the line, who's one of my favourite writers. He's an environmentalist and a campaigner, I guess known best across the planet for his articles for The Guardian, which are beautifully written and very heartfelt. And he's, I guess, one of the greatest sort of defenders of the natural world right now. Is that right, George? Is that fair to say?
I am a defender of the natural world, or I try to be.
Even to the detriment of your personal freedom recently?
It has happened, arrested. Yes. Yes, there's been a few incidents, particularly in West Papua, where I really cut my teeth, I guess, in the Amazon.
And more recently, you were arrested during the Extinction Rebellion protests as well. And our producer Teo, who's on the line, described you as a bit of a Cassandra, which is kind of, I think, an apt description of you, in that you've been kind of warning people about the sort of dangers of climate change and the sort of threats we face as a planet for years now. And it's often depressing reading, but really necessary, as we've literally just learned from this awful pandemic that's taken the world and really changed our lives forever. And I guess what this podcast is about is about talking about those things, the greatest threats to humanity, the greatest threats to the planet, what they might be, what the new ones are, not just the ones that we're currently in, and how we can spot them and try to avoid them, and how we can create a better world for ourselves. And I just thought perhaps we could start with you. You wrote a brilliant piece just recently about the other threats that we need to be taking seriously right now. And I wonder if you could just talk about them for a minute. What are the things that we need to be looking out for aside from the coronavirus once this is over?
Well, the two I highlighted, which, to be honest, are just two among dozens, but they're the two which are uppermost in my mind, were climate breakdown and its impacts on food supply and antibiotic resistance, both of which we've been neglecting for years. I mean, it's quite amazing, isn't it? We're now spending £40 billion a year in the UK alone on what we call defence, most of which has no conceivable defensive purpose at all. It can be used for attack, some of it can be used to boost the profits of the weapons industry, but most of it, there is simply no plausible scenario in which it could possibly be used. And at the same time, we've been spending far less on attending to both climate breakdown and ecological breakdown, which aren't like some potential threat on the horizon. They are current emergencies. And massively neglecting this other huge public health issue, which, you know, we're not even looking at in a sustained and sensible way, which is antibiotic resistance. In fact, government subsidies and government support in various parts of the world are encouraging antibiotic resistance because it's used as a routine prophylactic. Antibiotics are used for prophylactic purposes on livestock farms, because when you cram so many animals together in the same place, you're bound to get runaway disease happening. And so they put antibiotics into the animal feed to stop them getting disease at low levels, which is almost perfectly guaranteed to generate antibiotic resistance amongst bacteria. And those resistant bacteria can then spread into the human population. And suddenly, it's goodbye modern medicine. Because it's not just that you can't treat common infectious diseases anymore. All those diseases which we thought we'd seen the back of, whether it's diphtheria or scarlet fever or whatever it might be, you know, diseases which we don't even think about anymore because of antibiotics. But you can't perform surgery anymore. Because without antibiotics, you can't ensure that people don't get infected from surgery. childbirth suddenly becomes highly dangerous once more. With there'll be very high rates of maternal mortality without antibiotics. You can't do chemotherapy anymore without antibiotics because people's immune systems are so suppressed when you do it. So it's just like huge trenches of modern medicine can no longer be practiced. And what we desperately need there is a global effort to massively reduce the use of antibiotics, to preserve them for when we really need them, which is treating actual human infections rather than prophylactically treating billions of livestock. And at the same time, we need to be putting massive amounts of R&D into developing new ones to replace those which will inevitably at some point, sooner or we hope later, become useless because bacteria become resistant to them. So that's one of the two issues I highlighted. And the other one is even bigger. In fact, it's really the biggest thing of all, which is that it's now pretty clear, and there's been quite a tranche of scientific papers written on this recently, that somewhere between 2 degrees and 3.5 degrees of global heating above pre-industrial levels, we lose the food supply. I mean the global food supply. We see a very high chance of synchronous global harvest failure. So all around the world, major crops failing at the same time because of synchronous heat waves caused by particular ways in which the atmosphere responds to heating. We see major breadbaskets, places which are among the most important food producing regions on earth, turning into dust bowls. And we have all this sort of techno-optimistic stuff where people say, oh, we can just move farming north. Well, you know, with 3 degrees, you'd have to move it over 1,000 km north, whereupon you're into the wrong day lengths, you're into the wrong soils, you're in a highly acidified environment, often the soil's extremely thin. You just can't do it. The good agricultural land is basically where agriculture is currently practiced, and that's going to disappear as a useful and fertile place to grow crops. So, and it's just, it's quite amazing seeing this, and I've been banging on about it for several years now, and there's almost no take-up. You mentioned Cassandra, and of course Cassandra was cursed not to be believed. You know, her prophecies were accurate, but people would not and did not believe her. And in fact, it's a very powerful and important story because denial is a constant among human beings. You know, we deny anything which creates cognitive dissonance, which tells us that there's a difference between how we see the world and wish to perceive the world and how the world really is. And we'll do almost anything to avoid cognitive dissonance. I mean, people start wars to avoid cognitive dissonance. We see Trump currently enabling the deaths of thousands upon thousands of Americans because he refuses to accept this science that contradicts with his corporate profit-oriented worldview. And so, you know, he would rather see vast numbers of people die than take the measures which are going to have an impact on the profits of his cronies.
What measures are being taken by our governments or global governments in relation to antibiotic resistance and also the food crisis that you mentioned?
Such measures as there are in no sense commensurate with the scale of either crisis. So to a large extent, they've left it to the pharmaceutical companies to develop new drugs. And what pharmaceutical companies are quite good at is developing elective new drugs to sell to rich people. So they've been really great at developing Viagra and its various substitutes because you make a lot of money that way. But when it comes to things which require a lot of R&D over many years and which might not be terribly profitable when finally they materialise, it's just completely the wrong model. There's the wrong financial model for doing that. So really this has to be done through government. But we've been living in an era when we're told that the purpose of government is to stand back and let this thing called the market govern instead. And what the market really means is money. And when the market governs, it means that rich people govern. That's all it means. this thing about market forces. It's the force of billionaires and corporations. It's like, let's hand it all over to rich people. So it's a direct conflict between democracy and plutocracy. And when they say, let the market decide, they're saying, let the plutocrats decide and let's push democracy out of the way.
Right.
Sorry, a bit of a digression there. But what I'm basically saying is that the antibiotic resistance is a classic example where only government is going to sort this out.
Mm.
And it's going to have to be through public funding, public research, developing something that's for the good of everyone, but is in no one's immediate financial interest to develop.
Mm. It's a real breakdown of the social contract, isn't it? I mean,
yeah,
you rely on your government to identify real threats to the population and to protect you from that. Presumably that's part of the reason you're paying your taxes. That's why we have a huge nuclear arsenal. You talk about the comparison between the amount we spend on defence and the amount we spend to avoid situations like the one we're currently in with a sort of pandemic that is going to potentially kill millions of people, and it's a fraction of the amount. And I wonder, I think it was one of the first questions that was asked of Dominic Raab when he took over from Boris Johnson when he's sadly recently gone into ICU. The question was, who now has the nuclear code? So we're almost stuck in these dogmas from a previous generation, and we're not able to see the real threats that are just around the corner. Is that right?
Absolutely. Right now, we have an urgent need for international cooperation, but we're still stuck in this rhetoric of we've got to beat our adversaries. They keep talking about other countries as adversaries. If you listen to Ben Wallace, the defence secretary, it should be called the insecurity secretary, really, because everything he says seems to generate further insecurity and danger to the public. He talks of China and Russia as our adversaries. And sure, when you're trying to carve out geopolitical space and when you're competing over resources and the rest of it, one state to another, you can see that you can regard them as adversaries. And sure, there's a lot of bad stuff goes on in Russia and bad stuff goes on in China. But actually, when it comes to our common threats, we can't afford to treat them as adversaries. We have to be working together to confront climate breakdown, to confront ecological breakdown, to confront pandemics, to confront antibiotic resistance, all the other massive issues which we're currently facing. And if all you're doing is arming yourself against them and saying these are potential threats, you're never going to get past that mentality which allows you to start cooperating. Mm. And when you look at actually where the threats lie, the disputes between Russia and Europe are really pathetic. They're not major disputes. They can be resolved by diplomacy if there's goodwill and if you really want to resolve it. But it's a tail wagging the dog. It's the arms industry actually generating public policy by saying we need lots of weapons, so let's find some threats to justify those weapons.
You at all optimistic that some of the technology that's developed by our defence industries might come to our aid when it comes to things like climate change? I was reading your article and I was thinking about Haber Bosch, the German chemist who developed the chemicals that were used in attacks in the First World War, and then in the 1930s developed a process that allowed us to create what is now modern fertiliser, which, had it not been developed in the 30s, would have seen mass famines and our population be about half the size it is now. That was ultimately originally a military technology that was pivoted to use to help humanity. Is there anything that after this, if we see the world in a new light, fingers crossed, could we turn some of these big military industrial R&D complexes that we have to good use?
Yeah. So the argument, there's one way in which what you're asking is valid, because the argument we constantly hear from the weapons industry, it calls itself the defence industry, it's nothing of the kind, if we stop producing all these jets and selling them to Saudi Arabia to bomb Yemen and the rest of it, then a whole lot of jobs are going to be lost. There's no atrocity which can't be justified by means of employment.
Mm.
But the way to respond to that is to turn around and say, well, yeah, let's just repurpose the factories and start producing benign technologies instead, such as solar panels or, you know, microbial protein. I mean, there's so many things that we need to start doing.
I want to talk about that in a second, because I want to come to at the end of the pod, your sort of utopian and dystopian vision of where we might be after this and where the sort of, you know, different roads we could go down. But to stay on the sort of the apocalyptic issue for a second, staying on food shortages, we talked about what the government is and isn't doing in relation to antibiotic resistance. What is our government and global governments not doing to avoid a huge food shortage catastrophe?
Well, unfortunately, again, the government is leaving it largely to the private sector. And there's no question the private sector does have a role to play here. And it's very interesting to see the microbial protein and the cultured meat, which is being developed by some companies, which I think might have to be a part of our future. Because if farming can't produce food, if we fail to prevent climate breakdown, you know, if we do get past 2 degrees or whatever the crucial point is, which I, you know, let's face it, unfortunately, looks more likely than not now, much as people like ourselves have been trying to fight that against that possibility, then we can't rely on farming to feed us anymore. So we're going to need alternative sources. And, you know, it might sound scary, but it might not be that bad, you know, if that is how we end up feeding ourselves. I mean, everything else is going to be pretty rubbish, but that, you know, we might be able to feed ourselves adequately by that means. And last year, I was the first person outside the lab to eat a pancake made from microbial protein. And the amazing and weird and disturbing thing was it tasted just like a pancake.
Just like a pancake, as long as you forget the fact that it's made out of microbial protein. What does that mean? How do they make microbial protein
is literally the bodies of bacteria, in this case a species of soil bacteria, multiplied up and then dried into a flour. It's just like a yellowy flour, and then you make a pancake out of that flour.
Is that what it is? Does it say that on the menu?
It's not, I mean, it's not designed for pancakes. You could make almost anything from it, potentially. You know, cultured milk, cultured meat, cultured fish, you know, all sorts of things. So there, I mean, there's massive potential here, you know, massive potential, and all sorts of foods which we're not even thinking about now, you know, new, completely novel foods.
But our government isn't legislating for this sort of R&D. Our government isn't researching into this stuff to prepare us should we in this eventuality.
It's doing the exact opposite. It's continuing to subsidise the most destructive models of farming, and not just our government. I mean, this is happening around the world, where we see like large-scale ranching of sheep or cattle, which destroys vast tracts of habitat and exposes us to all sorts of environmental harm whilst producing almost none of our food. So if you look at the UK, for instance, we have 4 million hectares of land in the uplands, which is used to produce sheep. And it delivers just 1% of our diet. This is a vast tract of land which would be much better used as our great wildlife refuge and to stop flooding and to store carbon. But instead is used to produce tiny amounts of meat, which nobody's eating anymore anyway.
It's crazy, isn't it? Because we're seeing this in real time now. We're seeing the way governments like the German government and the South Korean government have prepared adequately or more adequately for this, getting tests in back in January, making sure they were able to test up to 500,000 people a week in Germany, which has meant that the death rate is relatively low compared to the rest of Europe. That seems to be a model of a government taking its responsibilities seriously in terms of the protection of its people. And we can see how our government and other European governments haven't been quite as prepared. And as a result, we're seeing massive death rates, which is just such a sort of stark example of the way in which, you know, the people that we elect, the people whom we give our taxes, are just letting us down and putting us in mortal jeopardy, essentially. And it's just, I think we're finally seeing this now because of this crisis. And I just wonder, you know, taking that example, what is it that our governments could be doing right now to protect us from things like antibiotic resistance and food shortage crisis, you know, before it's too late?
Okay, well, to start off with, you know, it's very striking if you look at certain governments, take for instance the UK, the US, Australia, all of them with massive capacity to have responded to coronavirus, because very rich nations with plenty of very smart scientists and amazing healthcare professionals and all the rest of it, and just sat there twiddling their thumbs and wasting week after week by not responding. And you think, well, why? Why would they do that? And then you look at where these governments came from, and they basically have arisen from decades of lobbying work, started by the tobacco industry and then picked up by the fossil fuel companies and the property companies and many others, to basically destroy the effectiveness of government, beginning with public health. You know, and there's been, and they've funded think tanks, they funded lobby groups, fake grassroots movements, they operated through the billionaire press, basically saying government has no legitimate role. We've got to privatise healthcare, we've got to deregulate, we've got to cut all the red tape, as they call it, which means public protections, all this health and safety gone mad. It's been this whole rhetoric, a whole terminology developed to basically prevent governments from protecting people, particularly in public health and environmental issues. And now we've got to the stage where, for instance, in the UK, this government directly emerges from that whole infrastructure of persuasion. When Johnson first formed his cabinet, the Institute of Economic Affairs, which is like the sort of founder member of this opaquely funded group of think tanks, which basically take money from billionaires and from tobacco companies and other forms of dirty money, but then refuse to reveal their funders, and we only find out later who's been paying for them. The Institute of Economic Affairs boasted that 14 of his cabinet members were alumni of its initiatives. Quite extraordinary, you know, including the Health Secretary, Matthew Hancock, including the Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab, who's now effectively acting as Prime Minister. You know, these are alumni of Institute of Economic Affairs initiatives. You've got Priti Patel, Home Secretary. She was herself a tobacco lobbyist, and she worked for a company called Weber Shandwick. And there's a fascinating memo from British American Tobacco, who had hired Weber Shandwick to do its lobbying and PR work for it, and said, "We're not very happy with the Weber Shandwick team because they seem to be uncomfortable working for a tobacco company, except for Priti. She's quite relaxed about it." To me, this is like psychopathic.
Right.
Yeah, they could not give a shit about public health. Yeah, and then a public health disaster arrives, and this is odd. They're not responding effectively to a public health disaster.
Yeah.
These people are there to prevent effective responses to public health and environmental and other regulatory disasters. And so we see something very similar to what happened with the Grenfell Tower happening with coronavirus. You know, there's no surprises there at all. So, second part of the question, what should they be doing? Well, the first thing to recognise is that we're not going to get the sensible and adequate responses from governments of this kind. You know, we can say they should be doing this, they should be doing that. They're not going to do that in a month of Sundays. It's just not going to happen, because they're the exact opposite of the people that we need to bring in the kind of necessary policies. In other words, long-term thinking with the general public interest in mind rather than the particular interests of billionaires and corporations and other powerful lobby groups. So what should a government be doing? What should an ideal government do? Well, you know, we urgently need massive research and development into how we're going to feed ourselves if that climate breakdown does wipe out our bread baskets. Obviously, ahead of that, we need to stop the climate breakdown urgently, desperately. And that means leaving fossil fuels in the ground. Number one, you know, just like a crash program to get out of fossil fuels, to massively reduce energy demand, to switch to renewables and other non-carbon or very low carbon alternatives. And at the same time, to draw down carbon dioxide from the atmosphere through rewilding natural climate solutions, allowing habitats to recover. And they, many habitats draw down carbon dioxide on a large scale from the atmosphere. We need to be doing all that as a desperate emergency crash program as rapidly as we possibly can. The one is not a substitute for the other. We've got to do both the keeping the fossil fuels in the ground and the carbon drawdown. But we have to also insure ourselves against the possibility that that's going to fail. Because unfortunately, even if you do pull out all the stops, there is still a high possibility that it'll fail because of the potential for feedback loops to start kicking in, where the planet takes over then as a major source of greenhouse gas emissions because...
permafrost melting in the Arctic and methane escaping and that
and the Amazon
creating
burning
a warming feedback loop, which is out of control that we can't stop no matter how much we stop flying.
Exactly. So we have to insure ourselves against that. And that does mean finding new forms of food production. Now, we can separate this off into different categories. Livestock, I think we just stop producing livestock. You know, they are such a strong driver of environmental destruction. Livestock farming is the number one cause of habitat and wildlife destruction. It's a major cause of greenhouse gases.
What does that look like in real terms? Everyone just stops eating meat tomorrow?
Yeah, we stop eating meat, we stop drinking milk.
How do you legislate for that? How does that, I mean, that seems almost, I mean, almost nothing seems impossible now after this corona crisis, but that does seem impossible. How would you stop that?
Yeah, well, I think you can't just do it from one day to the next. So, you know, you can start with sort of incentives and disincentives, such as taxes on meat production, for example. The first thing I would do is take away the subsidies for livestock farming.
Yeah.
Most livestock farming would disappear overnight without taxpayers' money. It's so perverse that we are paying for this one of the major causes of planetary destruction is only there in most parts of the world because you and I are paying for it. And that's, you know, whether you're talking about cattle ranching or intensive chicken production. People say, oh, but that's not subsidised. Actually, it is through the renewable heat incentive, which is a massive under-the-counter subsidy for poultry farming. That's the main purpose of the renewable heat incentive. And you know, there's a whole network of these overt and hidden subsidies for livestock production.
And for fossil fuels as well.
Of course, massive, massive subsidies. So one estimate, $5 trillion a year of subsidies. It's ridiculous. You know, it's just
so there are two things the government could do tomorrow.
Yeah, so straight away. And then at the same time, you know, what I would love to see is remove the intellectual property rights surrounding microbial protein and cultured meat and crowdsource it.
Right.
Yeah. One of the things we've seen in response.
I mean, that's incredibly relevant to what's happening right now with people trying to find a cure for the coronavirus. Right. It's like
new ventilators and stuff like that.
Yeah. There's people putting their stuff online for everyone to download. And
I mean, a classic example. You know, governments keep saying, "Well, you know, we don't have the ventilators. They're incredibly difficult to produce. They cost huge amount. I mean, the minimum cost is 20,000 quid for a ventilator." The parts are very hard to come by. And so this bunch of doctors, scientists, other experts sat down and did this sort of hackathon for a week, crowdsourcing expertise from lots of different disciplines, and came up with a design for a ventilator which can be produced from the most common parts, like sitting around on people's shelves, for 1,000 quid.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's called the Oxvent. And actually what you discover is that for innovation, crowdsourcing with open source technology can be massively quicker and more effective than intellectual property rights as a way of developing new technology.
Just shows what you can do when people cooperate against the common enemy.
Totally.
As long as you've identified what the common enemy actually is.
No, completely. And you know, actually we are an incredibly effective cooperative species when we're allowed to be. But intellectual property keeps stopping us from cooperating. It says, right, all this belongs to one company, so you can't go there. And you have all these really brilliant people looking at this saying, I could do that better. But you can't get in because there's a whole lot of things are tied up in property rights.
A lot of this stuff might have seemed a bit blue sky before this this pandemic, but now perhaps seems feasible. I mean, you talk, you were speaking just now about the system being broken to the extent that our politicians aren't going to do the things that they need to do in order to protect us from these great apocalyptic events, which may happen, you know, quite soon. But as we've seen since the coronavirus crisis, you know, we've seen Donald Trump, perhaps the most regressive president the country's ever had, suddenly instituting what amounts to a universal basic income, which was something that was, you know, that was, it was a policy of Andrew Yang, who was considered far too visionary even to be a Democratic contender for the presidency. So you've got Donald Trump doing that now. You've got, you know, where Jeremy Corbyn failed, you've now got a Tory government nationalising the railways, forgiving NHS debt, putting money into freelancers' bank accounts. This, surely anything is possible at this point. So if that's the case, and perhaps we are seeing our, you know, a big sea change in our understanding of how we do society, how we do economies, where would you like to see us go after this crisis?
Yeah, I mean, you're quite right. It just tells us that all those things which were literally deemed impossible, we were told, yeah, this is impossible. Oh. People would never put up with it. Governments would never do it. The money doesn't exist.
The money's not there.
Yeah, of course we can do that. That's right.
Sorry, the money is there, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the classic
The magic money tree.
Yeah. Classic example is homelessness. Mm. You know, for literally, well, decades to some extent, but certainly ever since 2010.
Yeah.
The government's been wringing its hands, saying, yes, it's very sad, isn't it? All these homeless people, yeah, what a shame. You know, it's a really, it's just a very difficult problem to solve, you know, and we just can't find housing for them. And, you know, the homeless will always be with us. And then suddenly it's like, oh, geez, you know, the homeless people, they could be a reservoir of disease. They could spread disease to respectable people. So we've got to get rid of them quick, house them. And they send out this instruction to local authorities, all homeless people must be housed immediately.
Yeah.
Oh, so it can be done. Yeah, it can be, you can do this. It was just a matter of political will.
Mm.
And all these things which we were told were like physical impossibilities. They're not physical impossibilities at all.
Yeah.
And all this time, you know, throughout all this while, we've constantly been talking about what is real and what is not. And actually what purport to be political discussions are often discussions about the nature of reality. And we're told it's not politically realistic to do this. Get real.
Yeah.
Know, I'm constantly told this. Throughout my life, I've been told, yeah, that's just unrealistic. That's hopelessly unrealistic. Get real. I keep being told this. And then, and I'd say, but, you know, of course you can do this. No, it's totally impossible. You cannot do it. Crisis comes along, whether it's the 2008 financial crisis or the coronavirus crisis. You just do it like that.
Right. Bizarre and how subjective reality is, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. Totally.
Yeah.
And all, oh, people would never cooperate like that. Bang, people are cooperating.
Yeah. You
know, it's just so many things which you can do if you want. And you suddenly find out that all these political realities are not realities at all.
Mm.
Scientific realities, those are realities. Physical reality exists. Biological reality exists. Political reality does not exist. Political reality is entirely contingent on what people think they can and can't do. And so when it comes to climate breakdown, we've been having this dispute about realities, because on the one hand there's people like myself and thousands of others saying, here is a scientific reality, you can't argue with the laws of thermodynamics. You know, this is actual reality. And then on the other side, you get people say, well, that's all very well, but here's political reality. And the political reality says that these are fixed laws in politics which can't be offended. And and people like me have been saying, well, why can't they be offended? Why can't those laws be broken? How are those laws fixed? We know the laws of thermodynamics are fixed. We know where they exist. We know the boundaries of those laws. I can't see the boundaries to these political laws that you say exist. I don't think they exist at all. And then we have a moment of crisis and suddenly, they don't exist.
It's perhaps it could be a sort of left-wing crash economics moment. I think, you know, Naomi Klein's book on crash economics and the idea of Milton Friedman, that it's only after great catastrophes that you can really remodel society. And obviously he wanted to remodel societies from a sort of right-wing, rather regressive perspective, whereas, you know, I guess we'd like to remodel societies in a much more progressive way. And is that possible now?
Yeah, I mean, it's so, you know, what Naomi was describing in her book, The Shock Doctrine, was what she calls disaster capitalism. And we see this operating even today, you know, where, for instance, in the US, they've cleared the pipeline protesters. In the UK, they've cleared the protesters against HS2, breaking all the rules, but using the opportunity to go in and do what they always wanted to do. And we've seen all sorts of...
Since
coronavirus kicked
right.
off. And we've seen all sorts of environmental laws abandoned right. in the US while everybody's yeah. looking the other way.
That's
so,
right.
yeah, there's plenty of that going on. But there is plenty of potential for us to do the opposite and to say, look, you know, we've had a glimpse of the fact that political realities are not realities. They don't actually exist. So let's make use of that.
On the dystopian stuff that's taking place, because that is obviously, I mean, we're a sort of fork in the road, right? And there's all sorts of incredibly scary stuff happening in Hungary with Viktor Orban banging up, you know, Jewish opposition members in parliament and journalists. And obviously what you just mentioned about the climate protesters suddenly being swept away using coronavirus legislation that's given governments all around the world incredibly powerful authoritarian you know, tools to use against their people. You know, in China, you have a situation where people are forced to download an app which measures their temperature through the screen of their phone to determine whether or not they may or may not have the coronavirus, which is incredibly effective at controlling the spread of coronavirus, but also has sort of dystopian 1984 style implications that I don't even need to explain. I mean, imagine being able to look at your entire population and read their body temperature and then be able to decide whether or not they need to self-isolate or not. It's the sort of power that you don't want in the hands of authoritarian governments or democratic governments like ours. So are we at risk? You know, we've already perhaps got a dictatorship in Europe right now in the form of Hungary. Could this go really badly? Could we see Donald Trump cancelling elections in the United States and you know,
well,
declaring,
I mean,
a sort of commander-in-chief type role for himself?
Striking. I mean, if you take a country like the UK, which, you know, prides itself on its love of liberty and its benign democratic government and all the rest of it, and, you know, and it's not the worst, but it's by no means the worst. You know, it's not nearly as bad as Orban's government. Despite all its deficiencies, it's not nearly as bad as Jair Bolsonaro. It's not as bad as Prince Salman in Saudi Arabia, or Assad in Syria, or, you know, there's so many places which are much worse. But even here, we see successive governments using what at first appears to be benign legislation to shut down dissent and protest and democracy, in effect. If you look at the 1986 Public Order Act, 1992 Trade Union Act, 1994 Criminal Justice Act, 1997 Prevention of Harassment Act, 2000 Terrorism Act, 2005 Serious Organised Crime and Police Act, all of those acts were theoretically designed for other purposes, and they were all used against protesters. Against peaceful protesters basically supporting democracy, because that's where democracy comes from. It comes from dissent and protest and criticism and debate. That's what democracy is. And they were all used to shut that down. And you know, this was done as much by the Labour government, in fact, arguably more by Tony Blair's government than by the governments either side of it. And and I remember when the 1997... Protection from Harassment Act came in, and Jack Straw, who I think was Home Secretary at the time, was saying, no, I can absolutely assure you this is just to protect women from stalkers. It will not be used against protesters. And we were saying, but there's nothing in the legislation which says it won't be used against protesters. And it looks perfectly designed to be used against protesters who, you know, whose protests And the first few cases, all of them against protesters. Perfectly peaceful people arrested for harassment.
And what kind of legislation is being put through now in the UK that could see similar things happening?
Yeah, well, we have this emergency legislation being driven down through, giving governments enormous powers. Now, you know, it's true that government should have certain powers to get on top of this coronavirus, you know, and it's right that we adhere to physical distancing and we limit our movements and all the rest of it. You know, I don't disagree with any of that, but the way some of that legislation is framed could potentially produce opportunities for the sort of authoritarianism that we've seen with those other acts that I've mentioned. So we've got to really go through it line by line, pass it really carefully, because, but believe you me, you know, I've been watching this now for 35 years and seeing how they use it again and again and again for purposes which weren't announced at the time. And if they've got the slightest opportunity to do so, they will use it for those purposes, to shut down democratic dissent.
We are in an odd situation where you have radical anarchists calling for the government to be more authoritarian and lock people in their homes. This is kind of the situation we're in. It's the perfect time for a sort of demagogic strongman to grab a bit more power, isn't it?
No, I know. Well, the thing is, I mean, an interesting thing is that radical anarchists have always been much better at public protection than the authoritarians have been. Yeah. I mean, I remember in 1994, there were a bunch of us dreadlock hippies sort of locking onto bulldozers and sitting in trees and stuff to stop these massive roads being built through all our scheduled ancient monuments and our sites of special scientific interest and other crucial elements of our national heritage. And I remember sitting in this tree thinking, wait a minute, I thought it was conservatives who were protecting national heritage and scuzzy anarchist hippies like me who were the enemies of national heritage. But here we are defending the national heritage against the conservatives.
Right.
What's going on here? And then you sort of look at the whole sort of historical picture and you see this is what always happens. It's always the communities. It's the sort of anarchistic organisations of people getting together who really secure public protection,
right?
Often against people who call themselves upholders of public security and the national interest. And actually, those people are often the greatest threats to public security and the national interest.
Right. On that point, I mean, the example I gave earlier of this app in China that the state is forcing people to download to track the spread of the coronavirus is, it's you know, the deaths and the spread of coronavirus that the Chinese state may have covered up would sort of, you know, slightly contradict that narrative that the Chinese state is doing a great job at, you know, suppressing the coronavirus through authoritarianism. You know, the deaths and the infections may be a tiny fraction of the reported cases. So really, what is authoritarianism doing to save its people from a crisis? It's difficult to say. And in fact, all the volunteers that we've seen across the UK who've signed up to help the NHS, it's that sort of stuff, really. It's the people in this community here that are setting up food banks on corners to feed vulnerable elderly people. It's people coming to get together to talk to people that are having mental health problems who are stuck in their houses. It's all of that stuff, really, that's, I guess, is going to protect us going forward.
So what does this tell us? This tells us that we need to see a radical devolution of powers from the state to the people. That's what it tells me, at any rate, that, you know, politics has been portrayed for far too long as a conflict between this thing called the market, which really means private money, and the state, as if those are the only two political places to be. You're either a statist or you're in favour of rule by private money. And actually, there's another place altogether, which is crucial to any decent and inclusive society, and that is the commons. That is communities acting together to basically take control of our own lives for the good of all. And we have seen a million examples of that around the world during this virus pandemic, of people doing that in really beautiful ways very often, you know, whether it's delivering food and medicines to the old people in your street who can't get out, whether it's making masks for health workers who don't have surgical masks, you know, all these people using patterns on shared sewing sites which they've been producing, whether it's collaborating on a new ventilator. I mean, there's so many ways in which this is happening. Yeah. And the trouble is we have a political system which is totally about dominance and submission. It's about control from the centre. You know, here we are in Westminster. We've got to control the whole country from Westminster, sitting on top of them and basically determining the structure of national life. And what it does is to treat a highly complex system, which is human society, which operates as all complex systems do in quite unpredictable ways with adaptive and emergent characteristics, and can do really amazing, wonderful things if you allow it to do those things, being treated as if it were a simple system. And our politics is highly simplified. And so we get this sort of linear top-down system, which has almost no scope for real public engagement. You know, our democratic duty supposedly is voting once every 4 or 5 years and then leaving them to get on with it.
Yeah.
And whereas actually we could have a participatory deliberative democracy in which we have a genuine role in political life any day we want to exercise it. I'm not saying get rid of representative democracy, but I'm saying we have participatory democracy and representative democracy running alongside each other, feeding back into each other. And we have a far richer political engagement. We have the wisdom of crowds, you know, crowdsourcing solutions to our problems. And we have a sense that the nation belongs to us rather than to this remote elite sitting in Westminster. And that is what taking back control really looks like.
What about the role of private industry as well? I mean, Marina Mazzucato's book, Entrepreneurial State, I don't know if you read it, but I thought it was brilliant in the way it sort of really deconstructed this sort of myth that we have, that there is a sort of a really sort of strict dividing line between the state and industry, and how all creativity happens in private industry, and that's where people are sort of resilient and agile and can pivot and do new things, and the state is this sort of lumbering bureaucratic leviathan. Whereas actually all major technological advances we've seen in the last 50 years have been a collaboration between state and private industry, whether it's the MP3 player, which is a collaboration between private industry and the German state funding research for 10 to 12 years, when you'd have never got a company funding research for that long because the profit margin just wouldn't make sense. You're putting too much in and you're ultimately going to lose money. And it's the same with the internet, right? We wouldn't have the internet had it not been for American military industrial research. You know, we wouldn't have FaceTime and the things we're doing now if the American government hadn't just gifted technology to Apple and other major corporations who made billions and then scarpered off offshore to avoid their taxes. So the commons, yes, and you know, all these geniuses online that are trying to do incredible things like cold fusion and then put that research online to potentially save the planet, but also presumably sort of eroding that dividing line between state and private industry and abandoning this sort of misconception that anything that the state does is negatively going to impact, you know, private industry and businesses, and trying to work out for the state and private industry to work more collaboratively to benefit the planet, not just profit margins.
And there's a fourth sector as well, which we shouldn't neglect, which is the household. You know, the core economy, you know, it's actually crucial to the functioning of all these other sectors. And yet it's always neglected in economic discussion. Well, almost always. Great book by Catherine Marcel called Who Cooked Adam Smith's Dinner?
Right.
Explaining that, you know, while the great man was writing The Wealth of Nations, all the actual work around him was being done by his long-suffering mother, Margaret Douglas.
We saw this in this recent crisis, right? When we're about to shut schools and suddenly everyone said, well, hold on a second, what about all the doctors and nurses that don't have daycare for their children? So you shut schools and the NHS collapses and suddenly you realise, oh my God, we should be paying people for their work in the house.
That's right. Absolutely right. So you know, the way we've been conceiving politics, whether on the left or the right, it's just been so mistaken for so many years. It's market or state, and there's a hard dividing line between them, which, as you correctly say, you know, shouldn't be there. There should be much more sort of movement between them, but, you know, recognition of the role of the state in the supposed market. But then there's, you know, the commons and the household just gets left out of it completely. But you leave them out and you actually leave human society out of it. The great majority of what human society does for most of its time is described in both the household and the commons, not in the market or the state. And you're just cutting out the great majority of our lives and ignoring their economic role and contribution, and ignoring how we actually live. So, you know, the economic models are simply wrong. And the political discussion arising from them is simply wrong. And again, it's a question of, you know, we're not talking about political differences here. We're talking about differences in the perception of reality. What is real and what is not real? Now, you know, the reason I scarcely have any contact with any other mainstream journalists, and I consider myself a mainstream journalist because I write for The Guardian, but I scarcely know any other journalists in any other mainstream organisation, including The Guardian. And the reason for that is not that I don't like them or anything. Some of them I do like, actually. It's that if you spend too long in the company of other journalists, it's not that you all end up having the same view of a particular issue. It's you have the same view of what an issue is. What are the issues about which you should have an opinion? There are only about 12 of them at any one time. And except for moments of crisis like this, generally those 12 issues are really, really trivial by comparison to the issues which are being ignored. We should all urgently have an opinion on some stupid thing which some minister has just said, whereas it's completely pointless having an opinion on climate breakdown because no one in the media is talking about that, you know. And it's like, and the disconnect between the total triviality of what is generally discussed, except for moments like this, and then the enormity of the things which aren't being discussed, that is where the real problem lies. Again, it's about the nature of reality, and the reality that appeals as reality to most journalists actually doesn't describe the real world at all.
To sum up, what do you think is the most important issue that we all face from here on out? And, you know, a lot of the sort of apocalyptic scenarios that you talk about, whether it's food shortages, whether it's, you know, also the problem of future pandemics, a lot of them are sort of related to climate change. They're climate change related apocalyptic scenarios. Would you say that climate change is the number one threat to the planet right now, that if governments were to focus on that and try to, you know, create systems and strategies to avert that problem, that would positively impact all the other apocalyptic problems that we're looking at just around the corner?
Yeah, but let's not call it climate change, because calling it climate change is like calling an invading army unexpected visitors. I mean, it's such a it's such an amazingly passive term for the huge existential predicament that we face.
Ecological
why I call
breakdown.
It climate breakdown.
Climate breakdown, yeah.
And yeah, absolutely, it is the number one issue. If you don't attend to that, there's no point in attending to anything else, because anything else is going to get swept aside by it. Now, it's not to say that we shouldn't be attending to other things. Of course we should. But that has to be the priority. That comes first. We've got to sort that out. We've got to get on top of it. Otherwise, all the other stuff, all our hopes and dreams and fears and all the rest of it become just irrelevant.
Amazing. Thanks, George.
Thanks, Hayden.
And fingers crossed that when we're all let out of our homes, we'll build a future that is much more positive and much more progressive than the one we
It's totally up to us. You know, it's not a question of sort of, you know, do we sit there and wait for what chance delivers? You know, will it be a good world? Will it be a bad world? No, we've got to create this new world. And now we have an opportunity to do so. We've shown how we can get together to do really, really positive things. Let's get together to create a new politics, a new economics.
The Rational Jihadi.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams 4th of July sale and get 30% off paints and stains June 27th through July 7th. With prices starting at $34.29, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.